Hello and welcome to the Anarcho Book Club. So today I decided to go ahead and record an episode, even though I said yesterday that I probably wouldn't be. But I was reading through, I've gotten about a third of the way through our book for this section, and which is, if you haven't heard, it is Leaves of Grass by Walt Whitman. And I wanted to cover Walt Whitman because, we read about him in the first episode, and we talked about him a little bit whenever we discussed Emma Goldman. And that kind of got me thinking, it's been a long time since I've read anything Walt Whitman has written, which is mainly his most famous work, Leaves of Grass. And if you follow me on Mastodon, you'll see that I decided on that and then published the last episode, and then began reading it and realized, holy crap, this is a huge book. I don't remember it being this long of a book of poetry, but nevertheless, here we are. So I got to a poem called Eidolons, the namesake of this podcast. And the ones leading up to it were, they made me think a lot about different aspects of humanity, different aspects of anarchism, and something I kind of, I mean, I've always really known this, but something I kind of settled on in my mind is sort of a definition of anarchism, and Eidolons sort of solidified this for me, although it may seem odd that that is the case, but it sort of solidified the idea that anarchism doesn't exist. Not really. Anarchism, the idea, or the ideal, you might say, is more of, it's kind of a lightning rod term for would-be statists, or for people who prefer the chains of whatever it may be it their government chains or their corporate chains or whatever it may be. It's kind of a lightning rod term, a demonization of a certain segment of humanity. But what I realized while I was reading Leaves of Grass was that Whitman kind of has an insight. From what I've read so far from Leaves of Grass, and from, I have been reading some essays about Whitman, and from what I've read, he never really identified with the Emma Goldman type of anarchism. But what he did identify with, something that's celebrated in movies and other books throughout history, really, is the idea or the ideal of being free. And I don't mean that as in the sense that people use it today to identify with the freedom given to them by their state or by their whatever it is that they identify with. No, I see this as something as being an individual, being someone who is free of all chains, free from, which I think may also be impossible, an impossible idea to be free from all chains. Because all of us, no matter what you do, you have some sort of a chain around you. Be it illness, or be it you're chained to the desk at your job, or you're chained down by something or another. And the idea that chains are evil is kind of a, I think it is a misnomer in the anarchist society. It's because the chains themselves are not evil. It's the chains that we decide to place upon ourselves. Those chains, the chains we choose, perhaps we don't see them as evil. Perhaps we don't identify them as something that is negative in our lives. So, say for instance, that you go about your daily life and you've decided that you really love, and this is kind of right up my alley, so you really love Microsoft Windows 10. You really love it, and you want to live by it. You, not live by it, but you want to use it and only it for all of your computing needs. Well, you've chosen a chain. You've chained yourself to that computer or that operating system, and maybe this is good for you. Maybe this helps you accomplish the things in life that you want to accomplish. And that's okay, I think. But it's the chains. The anarchist seeks to free themselves from the chains that are placed involuntarily upon them. So, say you're just a person living in middle America, and you have to have this dead-end job, works you 11 hours a day, but you don't really seem to have a choice. And, you know, and that's one of the things. A lot of people say, well, you have a choice. You can leave that job. But can you really? You can't leave that job unless you have an alternative way to support yourself, to gain money, as it were. Although there are alternatives to that, but it's one of those things where if you don't know about it, then it does not exist for you. If you don't know that there's a way to free yourself from the chains of the corporation that you work for, or the chains of the government that you languish under, then if you don't know that there's an alternative to that, then it does not exist for you. And that's why I kind of open this up with by saying that anarchism does not exist. It does not exist because all anarchism is the human struggle against oppression. The human struggle against corporate oppression, against state oppression, against oppression placed upon you by other human beings. It is the struggle to rise up against this oppression and fight it back. How that ties into Whitman's poetry is that his entire Leaves of Grass it's sort of an autobiographical epic poem, you might say, American epic poem. And it's to say that, and when we get to Eidolon's, he's identifying the problem, at least in his life. He's identifying the problem that he sees in the others, in the people that are in his life, and the people that he sees around. And the Eidolons are the heroes of a story, the heroes that we attach meaning to. It's the gods in mythology that we attach some sort of a meaning to. And this is where you could read, if you've read anything from Jung, C.G. Jung, then you'll see the significance here in what he's writing about. Because we all build our own mythology, see? And I know I've probably harped on this a lot in previous episodes. I honestly can't remember, but it's a core foundation of anarchism that we're trying to break down the mythologies that harm us and build up the mythologies that benefit us as individuals or as communities. And when you look upon the landscape of anarchism and you see all the different types of anarchists, you see the anarcho-capitalists, the anarcho-communists, the anarcho-syndicalists, all of the different anarchists, and they've named themselves, and they've built an eidolon, they've built an idol to themselves. They've built up this name, this idea for themselves, and it's something that they can hold on to, and it's something that they can fight for. And you see, it's not a bad thing. It's not always a bad thing, anyway. And you look around and you say, for instance, you are an anarcho-syndicalist. Let's just go with that one. And you look at your anarcho-communist friends and you say, you got some things wrong there. But we have common ground here. Or you say you're an anarcho-communist and you look at your anarcho-capitalist friends and you say, You got a lot wrong there. But at this point, I would urge you to see it as your friends who have opposing ideas to you but are still seeking to cast off those chains. I would urge you to say to yourself, hey, they have built this idea for themselves, and I think it's stupid. But you know what? This is an idea that helps them fight the struggle against oppression. And maybe some of the things they believe in are misleading. Maybe some of the things are harmful. But getting angry at them for this is not going to help anything. It's not going to help anyone. It's not going to help you, specifically. It's not going to help them. Because they will dig down in their foxholes in this great war against oppression. And they will no longer find any sort of mutual aid or give any sort of mutual aid to you or to the people in your specific sect of anarchism. And these eidolons that Whitman speaks of, he doesn't speak of them as if they're bad. He doesn't speak of them as if they're good. They just are. And I've written an essay, and it's not a very good one. It's a first draft, but I went ahead and published it anyway on the website, and just to kind of outline my thoughts on this. And I looked up the definition for eidolons in the Oxford English Dictionary. And the first definition is an idealized person or thing. And the second definition is a specter or a phantom. And so neither of these things are negative. They can be negative, and they can be positive. But neither of them is negative. And I think that's the point that Whitman is getting at with this poem. And it's not a very long poem. I can't remember exactly how many stanzas it is, but it's not very long. But he kind of encapsulates the idea of each individual building their own mythology. And it reminded me of the poem Ozymandias by Shelley. And Ozymandias, if you haven't read it, I'm going to link to it on the website. It will be linked by the time this is published. But Ozymandias, if you've not read it, it's a short little poem about a man. It's kind of set in, I don't know, it feels something like ancient Greek times, or maybe in the ancient Middle Eastern times. And it's about a traveler who he's traveling across, I believe it's the desert, probably. And I can't remember now. I should have read it before this. And he comes upon this great broken structure. And he sees, it's a statue, you see. And it's a great statue, or it looks like as if it were at one point a great statue. And it has fallen down, it's crumbled, there's nothing remaining but a single plaque. Or a single inscription. And that inscription says, "Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair." And that was an eidolon, you see. That was an eidolon for the person that built that, or that had that statue carved. It was an eidolon to show the world that this is my greatness, and this is my power. And look upon it and despair because you cannot fight against it. You cannot take me down. And that is what each sect of anarchism seeks to build. They seek to build. The anarcho-capitalists, they have their Rothbard. And they have their Mises. And they have all of their thinkers. These are their eidolons. These are the great structures that they have formed, and they look upon those, and they show those to the world and say, "Look upon these works, ye mighty, and despair. There's nothing you can do to tear us down." And the anarcho-communists and syndicalists, they have their thinkers. We've covered a few of them already. Well, Emma Goldman, although maybe she's more of a generalist, but Emma Goldman's one. And then we have Bakunin, one of my favorites. And they hold these up and they say, ah, you silly capitalist, or you silly statist. Look upon these works and tremble. Look upon these works, ye mighty states of oppression, ye mighty corporations, in despair, because I am free. And that is what anarchism is. It is a freedom in the mind, because that's where it always starts. And to actually seek it and to find it, that is the goal. The goal is to find that oppression and make it a reality in your own life. And Whitman seems to have, well, later on, I've read past this now, and later on, he seems to be seeking the same thing. And maybe that's why Emma Goldman latched onto him so tightly. And although I think in his time, she would not have been alone in that. Even people who were not anarchists latched onto him. Because everybody knows, everybody can feel it. They can feel it whenever they read these poems, that there is something there. There is a, maybe it's an individualism, but also a unity amongst all peoples. There's a unity here where we all seek, maybe not intentionally, maybe we don't seek intentionally this freedom from oppression, but we all want it. There's a yearning to find a state of being where there is no one in your community that is holding you down from achieving what you, from achieving that which would make you happy and that which would make your life fulfilled. And you see, after thinking about this for the last, well, for the last week, because I got to this poem within the first day or two, but after thinking about this for the last week, it made me realize that being an anarchist is not an end goal. This is not something that we do because we want to join. Well, it's not something. Let me put it this way. If it's something that you do because you want to join some sort of a movement to give your life meaning, that may not be the greatest long-term goal. And like with anything, like in the last episode we even discussed, The goal in the end is to change yourself and change the community around you, because that's what's going to directly affect you. And by doing that, if you and someone in the community next door and someone in the community next door to them, if everyone does that and they do something, they find some sort of a way to change just their community, then anarchism will spread across the world. And you know, I grew up in a very religious, well, my father was a preacher. And it's kind of the same mindset, I guess. We want to spread anarchy so that, or at least we want to spread individual responsibility and individual freedom, which we may call anarchy. And the reason is to solidify some sort of social change that will make life better for not only us, but for our neighbors and our families and so on. And the same thing is with the movement of Christians. In fact, some of the earliest anarchists that we have recorded, at least, were Christians. They were and I've talked about this as well. They were the Quakers. They were some of the earliest anarchists that we have recorded that are expressly anarchist. And it's because it's a similar goal to the Christians that anarchists have around the world. The similar goal is to create some sort of a safe environment, a safe, it's to create a world in which you can live, not so much for safety, but for a world in which you can live freely and do as you do what makes sense to you. And for an anarchist and an atheist, which I think tend to go hand in hand in most cases, you have to build up your, it's an even more difficult prospect, because you have to build up your own definitions of morality. You have to build up your own understanding of what is right and what is wrong. Of course, you're given some understanding by in your youth, but in the end, the final decisions are, the final formulation of morality in your own life is up to you. You have to decide what is right and what is wrong. You have to decide for yourself. And this goes for Christians as well. They also, they can't just take from the good book and say, this is right and this is wrong. They have to also decide in their own instances what is right and what is wrong, and build their own morality. They just, they have a jump start because they're using texts that have figured out a lot of it for them. And that's as far as morality goes. The rest of it, I'm not sure, but that is the whole purpose of an eidolon, according to Whitman, or at least according to my interpretation of this, is to build these things. You must have something you can look towards. And now, I personally, I'd have a hard time claiming any sort of sect of anarchy, because there are things I disagree with almost everyone I've encountered. And that's why whenever someone asks me, well, like on Mastodon or on some other form of communication, email, well, what kind of anarchist are you? Are you in my in-group? Or are you something else? And I'm at a loss for words, because though I came from a specific sect of anarchy, I have a hard time defining what it is other than simply an anarchist, simply someone who seeks, as Whitman did, who seeks a full life, free of the chains that are placed upon me. And of course, I may have my own eidolons that I'm unaware of, my own mythology that I follow, my own understanding, but that's the whole point, isn't it? That's the whole point of this whole exercise. It's to find your own understanding, build your own mythology, because a mythology is simply a perception of life. Mythology is simply a codification of what we see, what we smell, what we taste, what we experience. It's a codification of experiences, then. And perhaps it can grow stale. A mythology can grow stale and appear to be false, a false mythology, from the perspective of those looking inward, or looking upon your own mythology that you've built. But that's what all of life seems to be. It seems to be us building our own mythologies into the world, because it's our perception of the world. You have your partner in life, say you have a partner. I have a partner, and when we first got together, we had our own mythologies. We had our own perceptions of the world, and we still do. But the longer we're together, I've noticed, our mythologies, our perceptions, our codification of experience, they tend to mesh and blend. They tend to cohere to each other. And I take some of my partner's mythologies and integrate them into my own life. And she takes some of mine and integrates them into her own life. And we form a communal mythology at that point. And this is how it all begins. This is how everything always begins. And if you really look into it, this is one of the things that I have spent since I got to university and since I left. I continue to spend the majority of my time thinking about these things, thinking about mythology. I studied Norse and Greek mythology in college, and I studied Indian mythology after college, and I studied all these things, and in the end, what I realized was these mythologies, if you look at them as if these are, if you look at them like, well, let's take the one I'm most familiar with, Norse mythology. If you look at that and you read the Völuspá, which is the opening poem to the Poetic Edda, and you say, ah, look at these people. Look at these people that wrote this, and they thought that the world was made, they thought the clouds were made from the brains of the great giant Ymir. And they thought the blood of this giant was the oceans. They thought all these things. How silly. They thought that man and woman were created from two logs lying on a beach. And they thought that, and you keep reading and you say, ah, look, they believed that witches wander the earth and pronounce fate upon humanity. And they believe that one day there's going to be a great struggle. And the gods, their gods, will lose this struggle. And all of man will be wiped out save for one man and one woman. And from them will be birthed the entire new generation and the further future generations. And things will be great again. And it continues, this cyclical nature of mythology. And you continue reading into the Poetic Edda. And you see that cycle. And then maybe you leave the Poetic Edda for a while and you read about the Ring Cycle by Richard Wagner and his perception of that reality, of that mythology. Because what's really, and if you look at these things and you say, ah, these are silly stories, and maybe there's some wisdom to be found in them, but they're just silly stories. I can't believe people believe these things. But you have to understand that you're looking through the perspective of someone of that time, and they're making sense of things, they're perceiving things and making sense of them and building up a mythology, and what they perceive as a cyclical nature where the rise of humankind, it soars high and there's rivers flowing with milk and honey, and then it crashes back down with a great catastrophe, and you realize that, oh wait, so locally, in that area, or in your area, there is a rise and fall. And there's always this cyclical nature where great nations rise and then they fall. And great corporations rise and then they usually come crashing back down. Or they peter out in a slow, dragged out way. And you think, maybe they were perceiving something that I couldn't perceive before. And maybe this poetic illustration in the Völuspá is actually a painting. It's more like a painting of reality. And it's a painting using fairies and gods and so on. These are eidolons, you see. These things that they painted into these poems are eidolons. They're idols. They're things that give a firm, concrete meaning to what they perceive in reality, in the harsh times, and in the good times. And I think that's what drew me to this poem, Eidolons. It's because it just touches on this, but it just, if you've read any mythology, or if you've read very many poems, it kind of has an outpouring of ideas. It triggers something in, at least in my brain, in my mind, and it makes all these connections. And that's why I wanted to, this is why I wanted to do an episode on this, to kind of get all that out there, just throw it out there. And I don't really have a call to action or a call to purpose for this episode. It was more of something I just wanted to discuss. Well, for the sake of discussing it, really. That's all I really, the only real purpose of this. But I want to know what you think about this. I haven't yet gotten anyone to contact me on Mastodon. Maybe that's because none of you are on Mastodon. And I know there are people listening now, because although I don't really have analytics, I can see how many times it's been downloaded, or how much data usage I've had. And I know some people have downloaded it. So I want to know what you think about this poem. I want to know what you think about this episode. Tell me what you think about my ideas. Are they just ridiculous and stupid? Or do you think there's something there? And so yeah, just hit me up on Mastodon, or you can email the podcast at anarchobookclub@riseup.net. And you can find all of this on the website. And then if you want, you can go check out the essay I wrote. It's basically a more organized version of what I just said on this episode. So I think that's going to be it for today, though. And I hope you enjoyed it. I know it's a little bit shorter than normal, but just let me know what you think. So, all right. Well, thank you guys for listening, and I'll see you next time.